Thank you, Lars. It's as always a great pleasure to be here. Yeah, you may find it perhaps strange that I, as an astronomer, talk about the history of the discovery of Australia. But this came about because last year, 2006, Australia and the Netherlands celebrated their 400-year relationship. And in the course of that, Australian dignitaries visited the Netherlands, the Prime Minister, Cabinet Minister, our Crown Prince of the Netherlands with his wife went to a visit to Australia, and there was a lot of things going on. And the Ministers of Science had decided that it would be very nice for some fields of science where Australia and the Netherlands have strong connections, that scientists from Australia, scientists would come to the Netherlands, give public talks, and the other way around. And it turns out that astronomy and geosciences are the two sciences where the connections are the strongest. And then one of my Australian colleagues came to the Netherlands to give public talks, nice public talks in many places in the Netherlands, about Australian astronomy, and I was asked to do the same in Australia. But since most Australians think that Australia was discovered by Captain Cook, I thought it would be a good idea to also give them already at the beginning of my astronomical talk a little bit update on the history of how the relations with the Netherlands for 400 years, how that started. And so I had always, at the beginning of my astronomical talk, I had about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, little historical overview. And this talk here, which I give, is a little more expanded from that historical overview. Now, in this whole history of discovery, many countries played a role, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the Dutch, the British, and the French, as you will see in my talk here. The Dutch involvement actually was a kind of spin-off from the fact that in Flanders, the southern Netherlands, in the map making developed in the 16th century, and they were ahead of other countries in doing that, and I will come to that. Now, the first ones, of course, to go around the world were Magellan and Drake. Magellan, very early, the Portuguese, from Portugal. From Portugal, he went first to the east and discovered the Philippines, and later with five ships he made his trip around the world. Well, he didn't make the trip himself because he died in the Philippines, but one of the five ships survived and made it all the way to back to Lisbon, and that was in, well, around 1520, as you see. Drake was much later, and you see that both of them, after have rounded South America, they went to the Philippines. They missed Australia. And there was quite a good reason why they missed Australia, because there are enormously strong westerly winds in this area. And with those ships, you could just not sail against it. You had to go north. And they knew already the Philippines existed, so they went there. And they went back through Indonesia, and they missed Australia. And as I said, map making developed in Flanders, and of course the great starter of it all was Mercator. His real name was Kramer, which means peddler, but Mercator sounds a lot better. And he, together with his teacher Gemma Frisius, made the first globe of the earth and the first globe of the sky. But a part of the sky was missing around the South Pole, of course, because people didn't know that. As a Protestant, that whole business started already in the Protestantism started in Flanders and later also in the Netherlands in the 16th century, and there was a lot of persecution, so he fled later to Germany. One of his pupils made the first atlas. He had invented the idea that you could have maps together in one book with his projection method, the Mercator projection, for projecting a spherical surface on a flat surface. But the first one, he was a kind of a perfectionist. The first one who made an atlas was one of his pupils, Abraham Ortelius. And if you look, he was a Catholic, so he didn't have to fled to other places. So he stayed in Antwerp. And the first map the first atlas of the world by him was very famous. And you see here, New Guinea was discovered by the Spanish, and they called it New Guinea because the people have curly hair and are blacker, so it looks a bit like African Guinea, so they called it New Guinea. But you see something here which is not really there, so he must have fantasized about the whole thing. And Java Mayor, that is a name, it's important to remember that. The Portuguese often called Sumatra Java Minor, and Java they called Java Mayor, and this has caused a lot of confusion later on. Now, he had a later atlas from 1589, and there you see, he said this is this Australian continent which Magellan has not seen. It says it, but, and here he connects it to Tierra del Fuego, Fireland. But of course, this is all fantasy because there is nothing there which goes all the way from here to there. So they just filled in with their fantasy is the idea. On the other hand, New Guinea was known. Because of this religious persecution of the Protestants, many Holland, the Netherlands, northern and southern were part of the Habsburg Empire of Philip II of Spain. He was very strongly against Protestantism and tried to burn Protestants as much as possible on the stake, which the people did not like very much. And so many of the Flemish fled to the north. And in the north, we fought the Spanish, and it was possible, because there's so much water, to flush the Spanish out by piercing dikes and things like that. So the north became pretty independent already around 1570. And many of the Flemish people fled to Amsterdam, which was a big cultural impulse. And this guy was a Calvinist minister. He came from Brussels, and he was in Amsterdam. And he earned his money with map making, because maps were a good business, both maps of the sky and maps of the earth for navigation. And because of this trouble with the Spanish, the Netherlands was not getting spices anymore at that time, because the spices came from Portugal. The Portuguese went to the east to get the spices, but the Portugal became part of the Spanish crown, so we didn't get spices. And so he decided, let's go ourselves to the Indies, and he started with a number of rich guys the initiative to send four ships there, 1595 to 1597, and this was quite a success, although most of the people died on the way, as you can see. And one of his aims was to get a good map of the southern sky, because he had got information both from the Portuguese and the British, and the best information he could get, and which the British and the Portuguese had, was, for example, that the southern celestial pole is between the Magellanic Clouds, and we all know that this is not the case. And so he was very distressed by the fact that this was so badly known, and so he said to the sailors, you go and observe the southern stars very carefully. And so they stopped for several months near Madagascar to do this observation. He instructed them from the pulpit in his church to do all the measurements. And so when they came back in 1597, they had accurate positions of 136 stars around the celestial South Pole, which you cannot see from southern Europe, that part. And then Plancius got the stars, and he put them into new constellations, which 12 new constellations, which he himself invented, Chameleon, Pavo, Apis, Dorado, etc. He had already invented another constellation of Columba, and the first celestial globe with these 12 new constellations was published in Amsterdam in 1597. We don't have that globe anymore, but this is one from 1600 by Jodocus Hondius. His name was just Hond, dog, but he Latinized it to Hondius, which sounds a lot better. And Plancius' name actually was flat foot, but also Latinized, it's Plancius. Anyhow, he had these 136 stars, and so he had for the first time these accurate positions. It was before the invention of the telescope, so it was not that precise, but it was pretty precise. And this is one of his maps, 1598, of this Peacock, Pavo, and all these constellations and positions apparently spread over Europe pretty fast, because a guy in Germany, Bayer, who made this beautiful star atlas, he has already all these constellations, including a mistake of one of the stars, which was confused. So we know that it came from Plancius' first map. Now, one of these sailors, there were two brothers, Cornelis de Houtman, he was on the first expedition, and also his brother Frederick was on this first expedition. In 1598, they went back because it had been such a great success. Each was captain of a ship, and then they got near Sumatra in a fight with the Sultan of Aceh, and Cornelis was killed, and Frederick was captured by the Sultan of Aceh, northern Sumatra, and he was kept there for 4 years in prison. But during this prison time, he measured again the same 136 stars, and 300 in total, another 160 more. So when he was bought free in 1602 by Prince Maurits of Orange from our country, had to pay a lot of ransom to the Sultan of Sumatra. Yeah, this is where our astronomy graduate school, and so he had 303 accurate positions of southern stars, and he tried to sell them to Plancius, but he didn't want to pay enough, so he sold them to Blau, another atlas maker. And these positions of those 303 stars you still find in Kepler's Tabula Rudolphine of 1627. And for about 100 years, these were the best positions of these stars, until Halley went to St. Helena and with a telescope measured the positions of these stars much better at the end of the 17th century. So there was a connection with astronomy between these guys, as you can see. Now, in the year that one of our great painters was born in Leiden, Rembrandt, 1606, he was born in July. In February of this year, the first European who was recorded to have set foot in Australia was a Dutch shipper, William Janszoon. He did not know that he was in Australia, by the way, because he had been sent out with this extremely small ship, of which the Australians made a replica. It's called the Duifken, which means the little dove. This ship, by the way, was on the first trip in 1595 to the Indonesia. It's only 50 tons. It's just unbelievably small. But it's a very nice replica the Australians made of it. It had a crew of about 20. And on the third trip that he made, the third voyage to the Indies, he got the assignment, the captain Willem Janszoon, he left 1603 from the Netherlands, he got the assignment to go and map the coast of New Guinea. And so he did. And then a secret map of our, I should tell, by the way, since this shipping to the Indies was such a success, already the first 5 years after the first shipping, 56 ships left the Netherlands and went to the Indies. They were competing with each other. Now, people said at home, this is not a good idea, these guys compete with each other, let them get together and form one company. And so that way, in 1602, the Dutch East India Company was formed, and he was already getting the assignment for studying the coast of New Guinea from this East India Company. And this is a secret map, it says, of the East India Company from this voyage. And it's a rather, it's not very clear, but this is the Moluccas. Here is the head of New Guinea, which he called New Zealand, by the way. Yeah, it must get a name. This is another part of New Guinea. The people were very unfriendly and killed several of his sailors here. And then he sailed on, and then he thought he was still in New Guinea, and that's this part, and he mapped the rivers and everything. He found that the guys looked different from the Papuas here. But he thought it was New Guinea, but we know now that this is the north part of Australia, of Cape York, of a peninsula there in Australia. And We know that it is not New Guinea
because there is a strait in between.
Here we have New Guinea, here you have Cape York, and there is about 150 kilometers in between. And the amazing thing is, when Willem Jansson was charting this part in February of 1606, only 4 months later there was a Spanish ship going here through this strait and did not see Australia. This was by Captain Torres, who came from Peru and was had an assignment to go to the Philippines along the Moluccas, and he sailed under Australia. Nobody knew that this guy had been there until the year 1769, when an Englishman in the archives in Manila found the journal of this man and said, hey, Torres in 1606 went through this strait. And so then the British decided to call it Torres Strait, which is still the name nowadays. This same map of Jansson was already copied by a British map maker in 1623. They still saw that New Guinea is connected with this Cape York, and they did not know that this there is this Torres Strait of 150 kilometers in between, and all these rivers, are these names are all from this Jansson map. And you find the same on the map of the Hondius Junior from Amsterdam from 1630. You see in the corner here, you see again New Guinea apparently connected with Cape York. This was a lazy guy, because he could have made already a much better map of Australia. He says here, Australia is not known incognita. So, but he could have made at that time, as I will show, already a much better map. In order to have a base in Indonesia, the Dutch founded in 1608 a town called Batavia, which nowadays is Jakarta. This is a picture from around 1640, but it was founded in 1608. And the ships got all the assignment from the Netherlands to always report here. That was the real center of all the trade which was done in the east. Now, one of the sailors, they always stopped at Cape of Good Hope, Cape Town in what nowadays Cape Town in Australia. But one of the sailors, with the name of Henry Brouwer, in 1611 made by accident a discovery that if you go south from South Africa, you get into this 40 degree latitude region where the winds are enormously strong. And then you are blown all along this parallel of 40 southern latitude with a very high speed. And he found that if you do this for 7,000 kilometers and then make a left turn, you get in 6 months in Batavia. The other road along the African coast and along India took 14 to 18 months. And so when this Brouwer discovered this, that you could do it in 6 months, then all the ships of the East India Company from the year 1606 got the order, always take the Brouwer route, let yourself be blown all the way to the east by 7,000 kilometers, take a left turn and you get into Batavia, to Java. No, the roaring 40s are always there, all around Antarctica. That makes it a very rough part of the world, actually. And but the big problem is, you have to know how long, that it was really 7,000 kilometers that you did. And this is a very important thing, because the determination of longitude on Earth is very difficult. And it has taken a long time before people could do that.
you know that the Earth is rotating, and it rotates with a velocity at the equator of 463 meters per second. Latitude is easy to determine. You just look how high the pole star is or the Southern Cross is, and then you have the latitude. Everybody can do that. But longitude is very difficult. And just to explain why it is so difficult, suppose you need a very good clock to determine longitude. Suppose you have a good clock which gives, let us say, Greenwich time. And suppose you are somewhere on the world and you see the sun is exactly going through the south, but you have this clock which you're giving Greenwich time. You see the sun is exactly in the south and you read this clock and you see, hey, it is 11 o'clock in Greenwich. But I see already the sun is in the south, so for me it is 12 o'clock. Where am I at that moment? Well, I am then 1 hour east of Greenwich when I see the sun in the south there. So I know then 1 hour is 15 degrees in longitude. So if I have a clock and I look at the stars or at the sun, I can determine what my longitude is. If I see, for example, it's 13 hours Greenwich time while I see the sun in the south, then I know I'm 15 degrees west of Greenwich. But this clock must be very good, because if it is 1 second off, I am 463 meters when I'm on the equator wrong. At our latitude here it will be a little less, 400 meters. So I need an absolutely accurate clock to determine my longitude. Now these guys in the 17th century could not do that at all. So many of these Dutch guys overshot. They went for 8,000 kilometers, took a left turn, and then they ran into the southern part of Australia. And this is why you see a number of shipwrecks on the Australian coast. But it also made possible to do discoveries. And the first guy who followed the Brouwer route, Dirk Hartog, he ran into an island, which is now called Dirk Hartog's Island, on the coast. He came there and he said, well, it's nice that I'm here. He took a pewter plate from one of the dishes he had aboard. He hammered in that, Dirk Hartog, I've been here, and he put it on a pole, and then he went on to Batavia. Frederik de Houtman was sent out to chart this coast because the people in Batavia realized that there was this danger that you could run onto the coast. And so this was a deliberate expedition in 1619, and he discovered a dangerous group of islands and coral reefs which are called the Houtman Abrolhos. And Abrolhos means, as a Portuguese word, for keep your eyes open. You must have a little guy in front of the ship looking that there is nothing dangerous there. And this is a very dangerous archipel, this Houtman Abrolhos. Now, the ship Lewin discovered here this corner, which is called Lewin nowadays. And yeah, one guy overshot, Peter Nuyts, and he took the occasion to chart this part of the coast in 1626-27. I have no idea how he came back, but in any case, he came back. And also in the north, there were a couple of guys who ran into the coast and charted the coast. So by 1627, there was already quite a piece of Australia that was charted. And this was all thanks to this Brouwer route and the difficulty to determine longitude. Now, with this Houtman Abrolhos, these islands there, there was one very awful story. In 1629, there was the ship Batavia, beautiful big ship, which had left the Netherlands 1628. It had $40 million in gold and silver on board. Present-day money, of course. And about 300 people, also women and children. it ran ashore on this island and it was wrecked on this Houtman Abrolhos in 1629. But everybody was saved its life. So there were almost 300 people on the island. They were able also to get half of the money from the ship and all the food which they needed. And so the captain decided to go with 40 people in a small boat which they had to Batavia to get help and to send them back a big ship to get all the other people. But there was one guy, well, the captain left. He went to Batavia. He came back only 5 months later because it's a long way and they had to row and to sail. But when the captain had gone, the second in command was a guy called Cornelis. He came from Haarlem. And he was a bankrupt pharmacist. And he had signed up with the East India Company because he had gone bankrupt in Haarlem. But he was a very clever guy, pharmacist. He could talk very well. And he had seen all this money on board. And he had the idea, if I could get that money and get away, then I will be rich. I go to another country. We have war with France. So if I go to France, nobody will hand me over to the Dutch. He convinced a number of other people on board to join him on this island. And he had about 40 people who joined with him. And then they said, there is these other 250 people left here on the island. About 40 had gone with the captain to Batavia. They are a nuisance, so we must kill them all off. And this is what he started to do systematically with his 40 companions, killing off the women, the children, everybody who had been saved, except for his 40. But lucky enough, 40 guys escaped to another island, and he was not able to get at them. And so when finally the ship came back from Batavia, there were from two islands there came ships rowing very rapidly to this rescue ship, and the good guys came there first, and so the bad guys were caught by the captain. He had court-martial on the island, and of course he had these guys hanged who had done all the atrocities. And I was in this museum near Perth in Fremantle, and they have their skeletons laying of the people they have dug up from this island. And I saw one of my compatriots with a big scratch on it. Well, they just used axes to kill each other, to kill these people. So it was not a pleasant sight. The Australians have dug up a lot of the ship. The ship had a stone gate, a sandstone gate for Batavia on board, and the Australians have dug that up. It's something like 25 feet tall, and it stands there in the museum. You see a part of the ship Batavia, and they have done fantastic ship archaeology there. This gate never reached Batavia. They had only three gates because the fourth gate never arrived. They always used those stones as ballast for going, because going there you had nothing but the money, like silver and gold, but the rest they took bricks and stone and roof tiles along. This is another piece of the ship, Batavia, 1629, of this horrible story. And here you see part of the money, which many tens of thousands of coins which they the Australians retrieved from this ship. They are from all parts of the Netherlands. They are basically silver dollars and gold in the back, as you see. It was meant for Batavia. The $40 million was meant for doing trade, you know, buying things from the Chinese and from the Japanese and from everybody, and buying spices and all that type of stuff. Many of the ships which went there had so much money aboard for doing all the trade, because going back you bring the cargo, but going you have to have your money to buy. No. It was just on the way to Batavia. But they always ran into this coast because they could not determine longitude very well. So this was the problem. This Brouwer route was very good for getting there fast, but you could run onto the shore. And in this way, at least five ships have now been dug up by the Australian ship archaeologists, and many of them have so much money aboard. Now, the third deliberate exploration journal was from Abel Tasman, going from Batavia on the assignment of Governor General van Diemen in 1642. This man said, I want to know whether we can get south of this Southland, they called it Southland, or New Holland, can you get all the way to South America? Now, he got the assignment, go first to Mauritius, go south, 50 degrees south, and then let yourself be blown to the east and see what you meet there. And now, Tasman, with three ships, realized when he went south that you couldn't get to 50 degrees because there is already Antarctica and ice. So he took 45 degrees and let himself be blown. And then he discovered this island, which he called Van Diemen's Land. You see how fast the wind is here. In only 12 days, he discovered New Zealand. There, several of his people who wanted to go ashore were killed by the Maori, so he called this the Murderer's Bay, and then he sailed on to Tonga and Fiji, and after about a year, he was back in Batavia. He made a second tour 2 years later, to chart really accurately the north coast. And by that time, then, they had already done the south coast and the west coast, so they had already a big chunk of Australia charted. He did not discover that Australia is not connected with New Guinea, so he did not discover the Torres Strait. He still thought the whole business was connected to each other. And interestingly enough, the same year that he came back, 1644, there was already a very bright Frenchman who got all this information and made a map of how this part of the world looked like in 1644. This man was a kind of Renaissance man in France. He was rich. He had been ambassador to Italy, to Naples. He was a friend of Leibniz. He corresponded with all the great scientists of his time. I don't know how he got already in that same year all this information to make this nice map of this area. And amazingly, this remained the picture of Australia for more than 120 years. There was nothing. No advancement after that for 120 years. You see New Zealand here, you see Tasmania, which is called Van Diemen's Land at this place. It was later called by the British Tasmania because the British used it as a penal colony, and it was the worst of all. If you went to Van Diemen's Land, then you could not hardly survive. It was one of the worst penal colonies they had, and so when they stopped this whole penal colony business, they wanted to get rid of the name Van Diemen's Land, and they called it after Tasman, they called it Tasmania in the middle of the 19th century. They still thought that this was connected with each other. And you see this also on the Blau map, one of very nice atlases from the second half of 17th century. It looks exactly the same as what is Melchizedek Thévenot. By the way, this man was the one who had the idea to start the Académie Française. He suggested to Louis XIV to start something like the English Royal Society, which they started then in the early 70s of the 17th century. Was a great guy. The last discovery by one of these Dutch guys was by Willem de Vlaming. He discovered the bay near Perth, the Swan Bay, and this was again looking. This was looking for a ship that had lost. It was a ship, Ridderschap van Holland, huge ship, and it had dignitaries of our East India Company on board. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gone through all this trouble, I think. And they sent from the Netherlands this fleet with Willem de Vlaming to look along the coast here whether he could find this ship. It also again had a lot of money aboard. They were also looking for another ship which had been lost already since 1656, the Vergulde Draak. The Australians have found that one, actually, close to Perth. And that ship is interesting because seven people, they knew that 75 people survived. They had only a small rescue ship which could carry seven people. So seven people went to Java and told, hey, our ship has gone down there near Australia. Then several ships went out to pick up the other 68 people, which went on the coast near Perth, and nobody could find them. And on the way of finding the 68 people, they lost another 25 people from the rescue ships, which never have been seen after that. The interesting thing is that when the British came to southwestern Australia for the first time, early 19th century, they noticed that the Aborigines there, several of them were much taller than normal and had blonde hair. And the idea is that this probably is from the Vergulde Draak, from these people, because this was a large contingent of people. And they also found genetic similarities to Dutch people among certain Aborigines there. So, but they were complete Aborigines. They had nothing left from any Western European civilization. But it may be from this Vergulde Draak. There was another ship in 1712 which went on the shore, which has never been seen again. But later the Australians found that at least 25 people must have survived. They also disappeared into nothing. And I must say, from the horror story of the Batavia, there were two of the guys, of the bad guys, who were too young to be hanged. And so the captain said, okay, you're not going to be hanged, but we are going to put you ashore in Australia. He gave them food, gave them tools along, gave them little marbles and other stuff along to give to the natives. If you find natives, you can have something to trade with them. And so they put them on a piece where they know there was water. So those were the first two European settlers, actually, of Australia. And they have never been seen again. But it's all in the same area. That was the from the Vergulde Draak was about here. The other 1712 ship was here, where 25 people nobody ever saw. And these two guys from this Batavia ship, who were marooned here, that was about in this area. And they were the first real settlers then in 1629. The Vlaming was looking, he also got the assignment, look whether you can still find some trace of these 68 people, but he didn't find anything. He found, also not this other ship which has disappeared, but on this island where in 1606, Hartog had been and had put up this pewter plate. He found that pewter plate with the inscriptions of Hartog from 1606. And then he said, that's nice. He took his own pewter plate from his table. He copied the Hartog one from 1606 and wrote his own stuff. I, Willem de Vlaming, have been here. He put it on a pole and he hammered it also on this Hartog island. But he took the Hartog plate along to Batavia, and that one is now in our Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. So this is a pewter plate which is in our Rijksmuseum. The Vlaming plate, there was a French explorer in 1818. He said, hey, when he came there, I see this plate, I take it along to Paris. And then in the academy, they wrote a paper about it, and then it was lost until 1940. They couldn't find it anywhere. And then someone found it back in 1946.
The French gave that plate to the Australians, which now have it very nicely in a museum. They are very happy with it. They gave it to the Australians because the Australians had helped liberate France in the First World War and in the Second World War. But still, the maps of Australia, this is a map from 1763, you see that there was no progress at all for more than a century. This is a map published by some British people, but made by a French mapmaker for these British people. The idea is that the British at that time had already the intention to go and have a look how it all looked like there in the south. But you see there, Australia, Van Diemen's Land, Tasmania is connected with it, New Guinea is connected, and on the top you see the Holy Ghost Land. What that is, nobody knows, because the East Coast was completely unknown by that time. And New Zealand they had connected to Antarctica, so they had no clue what this east part was, etc. I told you that very difficult to determine longitude, and so you need a very good clock to determine longitude. In the year 1714, the British Admiralty had realized that, and they instituted the Board of Longitude, and the chair of that board was Newton, as chairman of the Royal Society. And other important guys like the chairman of the House of Parliament were in this longitude board, and the head of the Admiralty, the Astronomer Royal, all these guys were there. And they said, we are going to give a prize for someone who makes the best possible clock. And this prize was gigantic for those days, was 20,000 pounds, British pounds. And the requirement was that the clock should be so good that if the ship goes to the Caribbean and comes back, it can determine its longitude with an error of less than 30 miles. And those miles of those days were about 60 kilometers. Seems to you that this is still a very big error, but you have to be extremely good as a clock to be able to do that, because going to the Caribbean and back takes at least 6 weeks. 6 weeks is about 40 days. 60 kilometers, the Earth rotates half a kilometer per second, so this is about 120 seconds. And so this clock must in 40 days not run more error than 120 seconds, so not more than 3 seconds a day. That prize was announced in 1714. It was won only in 1765 by a fantastic clockmaker called Harrison, who worked on this for 35 years. He started in 1730 and he got the prize finally in 1765. One of his problems was that in the Board of Longitude, who had to decide about it, was the Astronomer Royal. And the Astronomer Royal had his own idea of determining exactly the time. He thought you could do it with the moon. It's not possible, but he thought he could do it. So this man already, his second clock, which he built, H2, was good enough to do it, but he did not get the prize. He worked on and on. The first clock was enormous, weighed something like 80 pounds. The second one was 60 pounds. And in the end, he finished up with this little clock, which kept time to 1 second per day, roughly. In the way he did it, he invented the ball bearing. He invented that you put diamonds in a watch, you know, for the bearings. He invented that you can compensate for temperature changes by using different metals in the clock. It's just unbelievable what this guy did. He was a real maniac, you could say, but in the end, he won the £20,000. And
It is thanks to this that the British then had a fantastic head start over all the other countries, thanks to this clock of this guy. And one of the guys who used that clock is, of course, Captain Cook. And he went, by the way, on an astronomical expedition to the South Pacific on June the 3rd, 1769. There was this transit of Venus, and the idea was you use that to determine the distance to the sun. You must have people at different parts of the world all having this good clock and see where, when Venus gets enters the disk of the sun and when it gets out of the disk. And then you can, just from by triangulation, by doing it at different places in the world, you can get the distance to the sun. This is very short, the story. He had unofficially also an assignment to go and look for the east part of the Australian continent. And so, after having done, he had two astronomers aboard, by the way, and he had also two botanic people aboard. And then he first charted New Zealand with his very good clock, so he made a very accurate map of New Zealand, and then he sailed on and he discovered the east coast of Australia. And that's of course the best part. The Dutch always missed the good part. They always had this awful, dry, awful part, and he got the good part, which is green and there are rivers and this is where all the Australians live nowadays. And yeah. And then he discovered Botany Bay, called by this guy Joseph Banks Botany Bay, and where later Sydney was to be founded. He made several trips. As you know, the first trip is the red one. There he goes. He's discovered. He did not see, by the way, that Tasmania was separated from, he didn't know that, that was separated from Australia. His second trip is the green one. He loved this Pacific Islands, you know, they had lots of joy with the people living there, let's say. And then, of course, his third trip, and you know he was then killed by some bloody guy in Hawaii for some reason or another. Well, many of these guys were killed all the way, of course. But on the basis of his discoveries, still people in 1799, although it was already a penal colony now, because you know why Australia became a penal colony? Because they lost the United States, where they always could send their convicts. And now they had no place to send their convicts, and so the first fleet full of convicts already in the late 18th century arrived here, and so it was a penal colony for quite a long time. But he thought then that Van Diemen's Land was still connected with Australia. And the first guy who discovered this is not the case was a fantastic Englishman, Flinders, one of the greatest of all, I think. And he lived only for 40 years, and it was really tragic if you really come to think of it. He, at the age of 15, joined the Royal Navy. At the age of 17, he went to Tahiti with Captain Bligh, the captain of the Bounty, which apparently was a bad guy, people say, or difficult, but Matthew Flinders had no problem with him, and Bligh liked him, and he taught him chart making, he taught him astronomy, and he taught him taking very good care of the clocks. These clocks were really important to get the positions very well. When he was in Australia on one of his trips, he bought a little boat, and with a friend of him, a doctor, Bass, went all along the coast here and saw, hey, Tasmania is separated from Australia. So he discovered that there is sea in between. Then he went back to England. In 1800 he married, but in 1801 he got an assignment to go and chart the Australian coast, so he went to Australia. He charted here most of it. One piece of 600 kilometers he could not really reach very well, so, but he charted most of it, went to Sydney, went back, and then here, this was 1801, here he met a French boat, and they were at war with France because this bloody Napoleon was in France, and of course the British were at war with the French there. So they decided, should we shoot at each other or should we be friends? We are so far away from home. And then they thought, well, it would be silly to start shooting at each other. So they had dinner together with the captain, with the friend. And this is called Encounter Bay. This is where it happened. And this French guy had been charting the coast and just had done the 600 kilometers which Flinders had not done. So they compared notes and they said, gee, this all fits very well together. And then they sailed back to Sydney. The Frenchman's ship was very bad, so he bought a new ship there and he sailed on. And then Flinders went with his ship. He wanted to chart the north part. But his ship became so bad and leaking that he then, after a couple of months, decided to go back. And then he said, well, now I go back to England. And then his second ship, which he got here, a new ship, was wrecked on the Barrier Reef. And then he had to row back with a couple of mates for 1,000 kilometers to Sydney and to rescue the other guys who were still left on the reef. And then he went back, and this ship was also bad. It started leaking, so he had to stop at Mauritius. And that is where the real disaster happened, because they were still at war at France, and there was a French governor on Mauritius, and he said, ha, this is a British spy. I put him in jail. He kept Flinders for 7 years in jail while he had all his materials about the coast. He took away all his papers, sent them to Paris. The French Academy published all the discoveries of Flinders. And he was sitting there in jail. Can you imagine? And then he got malaria and all kinds of other things which you get in jail there. And finally, he was allowed back in 1810 to go to England. Then he wrote his book. He came with the name Australia that was invented by Flinders. And one day after his book was published, he died. It was really absolutely tragic story. It was not the fault of this Frenchman which he met there, because that was also a great guy. This governor in Mauritius was the awful guy, of course. This Baudin, which he met here at Encounter Bay, was a very good guy, also a good explorer. He went with two ships from France. They explored the west coast of Australia and the south coast of Australia, and then he met here Flinders. And by the way, the other ships, Captain Hamblin found the Vlaming thing on this island again. He left it there, but he had this lieutenant on board and said, this is crazy, why don't you take this plate, you know, which is standing there of this guy, the Vlaming. And so when this guy later became a captain himself, he went all the way back to Australia to pick up this thing. And this is the one which finished at the Académie Française and was lost there then. But in any case, this man, after having done a very good job in collecting species, he collected 2,542 new animal species and charted 600 kilometers of the south coast. And then by that time, really, Australia was well known. And by the way, the Empress Josephine loved all these little animals from Australia. The story says the wife of Napoleon was very happy with the guy. But he never got back to France. It was his friends who got back to France, because he died here on Mauritius. So this is the map of Flinders. He made him in captivity, apparently before his papers were taken away by this governor. And this is the first real map of Australia, showing also the separation with Tasmania, showing Torres Strait, etc. And this is 1804. And so this story is the story of how Australia was discovered. And so my conclusions, we are indebted to a lot of people, wonderful, enterprising and adventurous people for four centuries, starting with the Portuguese, then a number of the British and the Dutch, and finally finishing, of course, with the British and the French. And of course, also, as you saw, for me as an astronomer, that's important, that astronomers, of course, also played quite a big role in all these type of things. I mean, you saw also that Captain Cook had astronomers aboard. This latitude board is, of course, largely consisting of astronomers, and astronomy plays in this whole game also a very important role. And of course, this Harrison, who invented the best clock, giving them, the British, also a great advantage. Thank you.
The United States also, eh? I have seen such claims, and there is also claims that the Portuguese have been there. The problem is there is nothing to really substantiate it. There is a thing near Melbourne which looks like a fortress, and so some people say it was built by Portuguese, and other people said maybe by the Chinese, and then when people really examined it carefully, it was one of the first British things when they built, when this was a penal colony. Actually, it was just the fundaments of it. And so there are many of these claims. Also, there were some cannons found on an island on the west coast, and it was claimed those were Portuguese cannons. And then these ship archaeologists from this West Australia Museum, they're very great experts in these things, they examined it and said, no, these were cannons of Makassar pirates. The Makassar, southern Sulawesi, they were fierce pirates all time, and these cannons were from their ship. Yeah. They went all the way to the east coast of Africa. That's well known, of course. That has been very well. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, yeah. Yeah, but you would like to find at least some piece of wood or some piece of stone or whatever, and yeah, I would like to know, has this been validated by real archaeologists and so, because there is a whole book now about the Portuguese discovery of Australia, and it turns out, what I understand from this is from a journalist here in Los Angeles actually. What I understood from the archaeologists that there is no shred of evidence actually, but it's not impossible with the Portuguese, because they were there already, and Timor is not that far away. I mean, the southern Timor, they were already in 1620, but no real pieces have been found. People also say, yeah, these Portuguese archives were secret, of course. It's the same like from our East India Company. And there was this big earthquake of Lisbon in the mid-18th century where a lot burned there. Yeah, but yeah, if you can't find anything anymore. Oh, sure. Yeah, but you saw this map was called secret, but still in 1823 already an Englishman had a copy of it. So I don't know how this actually works. Well, when Willem Jansson came there in this Cape York, in the beginning they were very friendly. The Papuas were not, and one gets the impression they may have already had European visitors.
For dinner.
Yeah. But Jansson and his crew were very stupid. These Australians, there were women also, and they kept one woman they wanted to keep on the ship, because they came to look at the ship and they let these people in, and when they wanted to go away, they wanted to keep one woman. And then the Australians got very mad at them, and they killed several of
of the crew. Yeah. But in the beginning, as far as I understood, they were friendly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You mean the Batavia? Yeah. This ship came back with the captain 5 months later, and then he had these two boats from different islands coming to him, and lucky enough, the good guys got there first. And then, they did not retrieve all of the about half of the 40 million they were able to retrieve, and now the Australian ship archaeologists have dug up the rest, actually. And it's a big business in Australia to look for those things, because there was another one, the Zuiddiep. I have a book about it here, which was discovered only in the 60s. And it's called the Carpet of Silver, because some people had said there, along a very rough coast, it looks, if you look in the water, there's a whole carpet of silver. And there was indeed more than 200,000 of these silver dollars laying there. And this was from the ship Zuiddijk. And then it was discovered by the government archaeologist, but it's a very rough part of the sea there. You can only 2 months a year, you can do something. And then there were some enterprising Australians who built equipment to also do something at rough sea. And when the real archaeologists came there, they had only 30,000 coins left, and the rest was gone. And nobody knows where the rogue guys have taken it away. And there's another of those ships. This Vergulde Draak, where the 68 people were never seen, that ship has been found. And also, that was found by private guys, and they got also all the loot which was aboard. It's a big business in Western Australia to try to find these things and get money out of that. Yes? The question is, how did the people, the Aborigines, come to Australia? What I have read about it is that we are sure that they are there for 50,000 years, maybe 60. They are Homo sapiens like us, which means that the Homo sapiens was much earlier in Australia than in Europe, because they came in Europe only 35,000 years ago, and in 50,000 years ago, Europe, only Neanderthals were walking around there. So they were early. In the Ice Age, the Torres Strait was completely dry, so New Guinea was connected with Australia. The sea level was about, at the deepest point, was 130 meters lower than now. And most of the Ice Age, it was 80 meters lower than now, so you could just walk. The whole Java Sea was dry during the Ice Age, because very shallow sea, so all the Indonesian big islands were connected with the mainland continent. This is why you have elephants on Borneo and in Sumatra, and so they have just walked over during the Ice Age, and tigers and all these animals. And so the idea is that they probably went along the coast from Africa, because that's the easiest way to go. Genetically, they seem to be related with the Tamil of southern India and with people from the northeast coast of Africa. The DNA seems to most closely match those people. Now, there is one piece which they have had to cross by boat or with rafts or something, because in Indonesia you have this Wallace Divide. It's a big trough on the east side of Sulawesi, which is 10 kilometers deep, so even in the Ice Age this was sea. And the species of animals on the one side of the trough is very different from on the other side, so in some way they must have crossed 60,000 years, 50,000 years ago, with at least 20 people is the idea, because if you want to start a population you need at least 10 men and 10 women or something for genetic diversity. So they must, in some way, have been able already to do that. It's quite amazing. The rest they could walk. I mean, Indonesia, they could walk a big chunk. And then they had to cross the Wallace Divide, and then New Guinea to Australia, they could walk. Yeah, you can do a lot of island hopping, I think. There are islands there. But still, yeah, they have to cross little pieces like 10 kilometer or 20 kilometer of sea or something like that. Yeah, of that order. The Papuas came later, I understand, and they are genetically more connected with the Asian mainland people. They came about 40,000 years ago, I understand. Also during the Ice Age. So they did also a lot of walking, apparently, to get there. But they also must have had ships to get finally to New Guinea. Something like that, yeah. Northeastern Africa, yeah.
Okay, back then.
Okay.